Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, a host on the channel, and today I'm very happy to say we have Waitman Bourne on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific book, The Holocaust in Eastern Europe, at the epicenter of the Final Solution. Welcome back, Waitman. Waitman's been on the show before.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always a great time.
Absolutely. Now, could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm currently a lecturer in the history department at the University of Virginia, and I also do some different kinds of consulting work for the Holocaust Museum in D.C. I should say, as a result of that, that any views expressed here are not the views of the museum. And my focus as a scholar is on predominantly the Holocaust and also genocide as well.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much. Now, you wrote a previous book, and I really want to mention it because I interview you about it. And as I said in the pre-interview, it's a truly fantastic book, and I recommend that everybody who listens to this podcast listen to it. Can you talk a little bit about that book? Just give us a short course.
Sure. So my first book is entitled Marching into Darkness, and the subject of it was the participation of the German army in the Holocaust, in this case in Belarus. And the historical question I was really trying to answer was, what does complicity actually look like on the ground, at the local level where the rubber meets the road? Because we often hear this term complicity, and it has sort of a vague connotation. And I was fortunate to be able to find a large, or at least a representative number of cases that allowed me to really drill down into what are individual soldiers doing, what are the dynamics of the organizations, how are Jewish communities reacting to these behaviors, and also, I think, expose some kinds of behaviors that are only recently becoming or receiving the focus that they deserve in Holocaust studies, one of which being sort of sexual violence and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it's a very, very good book. I found it extraordinarily revealing. And as I say, I recommend everybody go and listen to the interview and pick the book up if you can. So could you tell us why you wrote The Holocaust in Eastern Europe?
Sure. So I was asked by Bloomsbury Press to submit a proposal for this book because they have a series of sort of synthetic works related to the Holocaust. And the more I looked into it and thought about it, I was actually very sort of surprised to discover, and I don't mean to suggest in any way that this is any moment of brilliance, but that there wasn't a sort of one volume, very focused book on the Holocaust in Eastern Europe. Written for a more general audience. And that really energized me, I think, into looking at this topic and trying to provide sort of a one-stop shop for a overview of this very complex topic, but also being able to drill down again into individual events and personalities and the experience of survivors and Jews and collaborators and non-Jews and Germans and Nazis and all of these sorts of things. And I must say that it was also very interesting and challenging to write in sort of a different voice than I have before. And so I really, really enjoyed the project. And I think, as we may discuss, you know, a little bit later about why this is important, I think it's a, hopefully will be something that's very useful for the general reader as well as, you know, as a teaching book as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get right into the material. One of the things that I found fascinating about the book is that, there's a kind of thesis involved, and that is that the Holocaust as we understand it, or sort of the Holocaust of concentration camps and so on and so forth, the Auschwitz image, it developed over a period of time and largely in one place, essentially Poland. It actually was quite localized. We know the figures that were involved in developing it. We know the early steps they took, and their early steps were quite different than the later steps, and in a sense, a reaction to the earlier steps. So could you talk a little bit about this distinctiveness of the Holocaust in the East and how it played into the development of, again, this sort of image we have of the Auschwitz Holocaust?
Sure. I think, you know, one of the reasons that, and this is, you know, any of my students that are listening will recognize this sort of semi-rant, which is simply that I think that the Holocaust in Eastern Europe often, for a lay audience, is, as you sort of imply, in a certain sense, superseded by other versions of the Holocaust, if you will. And I always sort of mention Anne Frank in this example. You know, not that there's anything, I mean, her story is amazing and is incredibly important. For many people, at least in America, you know, that is often their only experience in sort of the public education system with the Holocaust. And they're dealing, of course, with someone who is highly assimilated, non-observant, upper middle class in Western Europe, which demographically, if you look at the Holocaust, is absolutely an outlier. And so I felt like it was, the more I got into this project, that it was really important, not in a competitive, you know, sense, but to provide this, you know, this other focus of saying, hey, you know, the average, if you will, demographically, the average victim, Jewish victim of the Holocaust, you know, is a Orthodox or relatively Orthodox Jew, usually very observant, someone who lives in Eastern Europe, very often, you know, not necessarily in a large city, etc. And so when I wrote this book, I tried to really introduce the entire region and the history that's relevant to that region into the history of the Holocaust, right? So, you know, two of the things that I think make this book perhaps particularly useful are the discussions of sort of why Eastern Europe, because there is a reason why the Germans, and I say Germans intentionally, because it's not just the Nazis, it predates the Nazis. You know, what is the obsession with Eastern Europe? Because it's not just to get at Jewish populations. There's a imperialist and colonialist sort of attitude. And then also the Soviet period, right, which is, I think, sort of something that's been driven in recent years by the work of Timothy Snyder, depending on – it doesn't really matter where one stands on that, but he certainly has highlighted the importance of that period. And then, you know, to get to your – I think your question, one of the things that I think is really important and illustrative in Eastern Europe is I think that maybe there are two or three things or 100, but – one is that, yes, it definitely is a place where we can see the incremental and developmental steps that lead us to a physical solution to the so-called Jewish question rather than a territorial one. In other words, to murder rather than to try to displace populations. And we can sort of see and track how that policy evolves and see that there are people, Nazis, you know, trying in different ways to solve it and are having relative, successes and failures, based on a variety of different aspects. So that's one thing I think is an important area of discussion. The second is, the nature of collaboration in the East is, I think, fundamentally different than it is in the West, both at a local individual scale as well as in some cases at a governmental scale. It is a different way to look at how non-Jews participated in the Holocaust, again, as collaborators, but also as rescuers. I mean, I think these things are important to always highlight together. There are the steps that we can sort of illustrate, and then the lessons learned, if you will, from the euthanasia program, but also from the beginnings in Eastern Europe, are then applied to create a system that then is applied to all of Western Europe as well. So,
I guess one thing that I was hinting at, I didn't say explicitly, is that if you look at, and Christopher Browning has done a good job of this, but a lot of people have, if you look at the various policies that were instituted, some they seem to have come from Hitler himself and others from his lieutenants, that they seem kind of hesitant and halting, and they're opportunistic. And the one that always blows my mind every time I read about it is the Madagascar plan. Mm-hmm. That actually, it held on for a long time. And I just don't think people realize this.
Yeah, and it's often something I think that sometimes, and again, there was sort of a more clearly divided line between people who thought that sort of everything was planned from the beginning and people who thought that it was, sort of an ad hoc developmental process. This is the intentionalist functionalist debate. But one of the things that, that when you really sort of drill down into the Madagascar plan is that it's not window dressing. There are entire departments trying to sort this out, Hans Frank, who is the administrator of Poland, even mentions, we don't have to do certain ghettoization processes right now because there's going to be this Madagascar plan. And, that's one great example of this. And by being able to sort of, one of the things that I think is interesting in tracing these developments is you have this intersection of the ideology and the high level thought. And then you have people like Hans Frank again, who, one of the plans is to basically dump all the Jews of Western Europe into a reservation, intentionally called that, in Poland. And Hans Frank essentially has a not in my backyard sort of attitude, because he's trying to also create some sort of a German colonial utopia. And he fights it on that level. So even people that sort of agree about what should be done in general have sort of I don't want to be, I don't want all these people dumped on my shoulders to be responsible for. And so you have these various plans and policies that never quite come to fruition, which sort of then lead us to, what we would, I guess, refer to as sort of the formal Holocaust or the extermination portion of the larger Nazi genocidal project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's hardly a straight line, and I'm reminded of another interview I did with Catherine Epstein, who wrote this terrific biography of Otto Preiser, who was the head of the Vartigau, I think, or was it?
Yeah, that's a fantastic book.
Anyway, it's a good book because it shows him fighting with pretty much everyone else about what to do with, and it sounds callous to say, his Jews. Like, he didn't want them there, but nobody else would take them, and this causes him endless headaches. He doesn't want to kill them. He doesn't have the mechanism. He doesn't have the ability to kill them. He doesn't even have the allowance to kill them. But you can just see that they are at cross purposes all the time because they're all trying to do different things. And this solution is kind of cobbled together. And it's kind of independently of one another. When I say that, I'm thinking explicitly about one of the most fascinating parts of your book, and I think about the Holocaust in general, and that is the role of the Einsatzgruppen. That they don't start as essentially an exterminationist, I guess, entity, but they become one. Can you talk a little bit about them? I mean, they were around even during the invasion of Czechoslovakia, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point to bring up. They have several iterations, if you will, of these Einsatzgruppen, right? And you mentioned the Czech version. There's and in this sense, they're really sort of almost these, almost exactly what the term translates to, sort of special, you know, special mission groups or whatnot, operational groups. And they were basically there to go, you know, secure buildings and, you know, files and records and identify potential enemies. And then this sort of evolves in Poland into much more of a killing mission, but it's a limited killing mission with, you know, particular types of people. So, you know, nationalists, local leaders, Jewish leaders, often Jewish men, but often in some kind of retaliatory sense. And then you move into the Soviet Union. And I think what's fascinating there is, first, you know, there's this giant expansion in numbers. There is a concerted effort this time to read in the Wehrmacht and other organizations about exactly what these guys are going to be doing, because one of the problems in Poland, or one of the sort of hiccups in Poland, was some, and again, I don't want to overplay this at all, but some officers and other folks were surprised and shocked at the brutality of what these people were doing, and at a very minimum, from just sort of a, you know, this is not what we do in an honorable sense kind of thing. That goes away by the time you get to the invasion of the East. You know, that is something that is now cleared up with everyone. The relationships are laid out on paper so that everyone knows, you know, what their responsibilities are regarding these individuals, these groups. And then you have the groups themselves, which are quite interesting, because number one, the leadership, of course, is highly indoctrinated, highly chosen for their abilities and for their dedication, but also happens to be incredibly educated. You know, like most of these guys have PhDs, many, at least a couple have two doctoral level degrees, either in law or medicine. It's kind of amazing, you know, how educated some of these people are, particularly when they're lawyers, you know. And then you have the men, who are often, at least initially, a hodgepodge of people drawn from, you know, a police graduating class or the Waffen-SS or whatever. And they are not necessarily chosen for any particular ideological fervor, but they're just sort of the manpower that's available. And then they are involved in this killing process that itself escalates. And, you know, initially it's already escalated from Poland to include all Jewish men of military age, as well as communist functionaries, as well as commissars in Red Army. But one of sort of the signposts, if you will, of the changing winds towards an exterminationist viewpoint is, again, in the Soviet Union or in the occupied Eastern Europe, where you start to see in the late summer of, or even in July, really, of 41, that these groups begin to kill Jews of all ages, of all genders, sort of indiscriminately. And, you know, one of the ways, and it's also interesting about how we try to figure this out, is you can almost plot where Himmler is traveling. And after he has conversations with people, for example, in Bialystok, he has a conversation, you know, and then immediately thereafter, the demographics of the victims begins to change. And so what we're seeing, I think, there is a verbal transmission of this change in policy, because after the sort of embarrassment of the euthanasia program, where the German population, at least some of them, you know, rise up and say this is not appropriate, and Hitler is sort of forced to back down, and he sort of had signed off on that on paper. But that time we get to the Soviet Union, he doesn't sign off on things on paper anymore. So, you know, that's why we sort of have this. I mean, Chris has pointed this out in his work. But we have what seems to be a more informal or verbal transmission that this is what's going to be happening. And that's one of the signposts, because, you know, one of the debates that goes on, that I think is still important, is how do we know when this shift was made from a territorial to a physical, you know, solution. And one of the ways to look at that, it's a compilation of sort of circumstantial evidence that the preponderance of the evidence, you know, can lead one to date it at this particular time period. And the Einsatzgruppen is one piece of that.
Mm-hmm. And I read Browning's entire book, pardon me, on the subject of the Genesis, where he actually tracks Hitler's movements like day by day and who he was meeting with. I think it's just called The Origins of the Final Solution. Do you remember what it's called? I think that's what it's called. But anyway, what is the consensus now about when that switch was made?
I mean, it depends on who you ask. There are still people who, again, as I said, I think the black and white feature of this debate has gone away. So we are definitely in a gray, you know, area between, you know, at the far extreme, this is just something that sort of ad hoc developed, and the other extreme, that this is something that was planned from the beginning. So there are lots of different answers to the question. The one that I find most compelling, and I think is also the one that Chris presents in Origins of Final Solution, is that sometime in the late summer, early fall of 1941 is when the decision was made. When it seemed like the German army was going from victory to victory, and there was no reason to sort of wait until the end of the war to deal with this, because it looked like it could be done now. And some of the key moments that I kind of try to highlight in the book, you know, you start to see, again, this change in the Einsatzgruppen behavior. You see the orders begin to go out for the creation and construction of what will become the Operation Reinhardt extermination centers. You see, and this is something that, again, this is something that Chris Browning points out, you know, in October, all immigration of Jews from German-controlled territory is forbidden, you know, and that is a pretty clear sign if you read it that way, that, you know, why let these people now leave if the plan is to have to round them up all and kill them at some point? Whereas before, you know, Eichmann's first job was to try to drive as many Jews as possible out of Vienna and out of Austria and make them immigrate. So once that changes, you know, and then by December, I think 8th of 1941, you have Kelmno already using gas vans to exterminate people. So, you know, what I find most compelling is that period of time. There are others who, you know, will date it a little farther into the future, into 1942. But the explanation that I find most compelling is sometime summer, fall of 1941.
Mm-hmm. I'm remembering one particular instance, and I don't recall exactly the details, but it involved, and I remember thinking it was very chilling and strange, it involved the sending of a train full of German Jews. I think they were from like Hamburg or something to, I want to say Lithuania.
It might have been to Riga in Latvia as well.
It may have been to Riga. And it was in 41, and it was very early. And people got in trouble for it.
I'm not familiar with that that particular episode.
Yeah, but anyway, essentially what happened was, it was in 41, and somebody got overenthusiastic and sent a trainload full of German Jews to Riga, essentially to be killed. And I remember somebody got in a lot of trouble for it, and Hitler personally was involved with this, and he was really pissed that this had happened. And I wish I could remember the details of it. It was very telling, because you could see that the various levels of the administration were not on the same page about what was supposed to happen and the timetable and how and these kinds of things. I think the train might have even been sent back. Maybe one of our listeners can enlighten me about this. But it was a very early instance, yeah.
Right. I mean, I think – I was going to say, I think that is though I'm not familiar with the details of that episode, you know, again, I think it's an interesting way to highlight what the East meant in a certain sense, you know, because certainly, you know, Hitler wants to get rid of the Jews, you know, there's no debate about that. But he's also very sensitive to public opinion, you know, and to when the time may be right to start doing this sort of thing, which would explain, you know, why he's angry about this. And even then you have sort of weird dissonance, even later on when German Jews start arriving in Minsk, and the Nazi administrator there wants them to, even though they're going to be killed, he wants them to be treated better because they are, in fact, German Jews, and they're different than the Ostjuden. Whereas in Eastern Europe, you know, these kinds of experiments and I mean, the experiments just in terms of killing methods are incredibly gruesome. But they're able to sort of take place there so that everything is set up when the timing then becomes right in Western Europe to begin deporting Western European Jews to these places. And so you have, for example, the Einsatzgruppen, and once they become stationary, you know, they begin killing Eastern European Jews in Eastern European ghettos to make space for Western European Jews, German Jews, and elsewhere to come to these places at least temporarily, you know. So there is a connection there that where the East plays an important role.
And then there's a further connection because, and I don't know where I got this, probably from your book, but they were resettling Volksdeutsche in Eastern European cities, and they needed flats for them. So they were ejecting the Jews there and sending them off. But to where? This is what Greiser, I remember Greiser was just totally out of his mind about this because he needed space for the Germans. And he didn't have it. And he just sent these Jews someplace, but he didn't know where. And Frank didn't want them. And so, I mean, again, it shows like it's all interconnected and very complicated. Go ahead.
Absolutely. No, and there's some really fantastic scholarship out there on these attempts to essentially colonize Eastern Europe with either Volksdeutsche or even Reichsdeutsche. For the listeners, you know, Germans who live in Germany or these ethnic Germans that live in Eastern Europe and have, you know, for a very long time and provide the kernel of this sort of myth that, you know, the Germans built Eastern Europe and anything good in Eastern Europe was created by the Germans, to the extent that you have this really fantastically ironic travel guide created by essentially the, you know, major travel guide writer in Germany, where they describe certain Polish towns and wherever there's a nice church or something, it was clearly built by the Germans at some point. But to get back to sort of there is this massive demographic engineering project of which the Holocaust and the Jewish deportations is part of it. But it's also part of this larger, and Himmler, of course, is especially intrigued and dedicated to this idea of resettling these people. But it's just almost a bridge too far because there's so many people and so many moving parts that you have examples of Volksdeutsche, you know, who have been pulled from someplace in Eastern Europe, who essentially end up living in a refugee camp for most of the war because they can't find a place to put them or they can't get them there, or, you know, And that's not for lack of trying, because a lot of these provincial Nazi officials are vying to be the first one to really Germanize their particular region. But they're, you know, again, like as you mentioned, there are all these competing sort of real world, realpolitik reasons that are, I think, not necessarily always in line with the larger abstract Nazi goal, which is, again, another important reason to kind of look at things at a local level.
Mm-hmm. Let's return for just a second to the question of when the Holocaust was, I want to say organized, when it was decided that they were going to make a concerted and unified effort to do this. Now, how does the Wannsee Conference fit into that according to current scholarship? I think some people who studied the Holocaust would know what the Wannsee, and explain what that is. How do historians now talk about the Wannsee Conference?
Sure. So there's a on January 20th, 1942, there is a meeting in a villa on the Wannsee, which is a really beautiful lake on the outskirts of Berlin, and essentially it brings together very important Nazi representatives of sort of all of the government agencies that would be involved in the deportation of European Jews, as well as elements of the Holocaust in Eastern Europe. And it's led by Heydrich, and Adolf Eichmann is also there. And one of the misconceptions I think that many people, or at least those who are familiar with it, have is that this was the moment, right, when these people meet together to decide that, okay, now we're going to solve this problem in a physical sense. But really, this meeting had already been scheduled, actually, I believe, for December 12th, if I'm accurate, December 12th, 1941, or at least December 1941, and had to be postponed because of December 7th, 1941, where, you know, the Americans enter the war against the Japanese and Hitler makes the decision to declare war against the Americans. So there's actually a lot going on at this moment. And so this meeting has to be postponed because everybody's busy with other things. What's interesting is the representatives are usually at this conference are usually like the second to the you know, secretary. You know, so Hans Frank sends his representative to this meeting. And what this meeting really becomes and really is not a decision of whether or not, but a decision of how. And so you have individuals, former Einsatzgruppen folks, you have representatives from the economic apparatus, from the legal apparatus, because one of the issues is to determine, you know, who is a Jew and who is a first-class mixed race and second-class mixed race and who gets deported and who doesn't, and representatives from, you know, all the organizations or organs of the government that are going to be involved in implementation. And so that's sort of reason number one for this meeting. And then the second reason, which is a little more insidious but made very clear, is Heydrich establishing the authority of the SS and the Reich Security Main Office for carrying out this final solution. He wants to make sure everyone knows and agrees that he is in charge and that the SS are in charge, which is important not only on its face, but for Himmler, you know, and his standing within sort of the Hitler's underlings in terms of power, that kind of thing. If you're in charge of this particular project, that gives you a great deal of power and significance for Hitler and in Hitler's inner circle. So that's really what the Wannsee Conference is about. It's not a decision point. It's a coordination meeting of sort of how do we go about doing this.
Mm-hmm. I want to touch on one other thing. This has to do with an interview that I did with a guy, and I don't remember his name, who wrote a biography of Eichmann, who was there at the Wannsee Conference. It was quite a revelation to me because I feel like I was misled by Hannah Arendt. Can you talk about what people say about Eichmann now?
Yeah,
and
I think
the banality of evil.
You know, I think that Chris Browning put it, you know, most accurately when he said that Hannah Arendt's theory is not necessarily off. She just picked the wrong guy. You know, certainly, and Raoul Hilberg, when he talks about the rail with the Deutsche Bahn, you know. Those are great examples of sort of the banality of evil. In Claude Lanzmann's Shoah, when he interviews the railway official, who is basically talking about special trains in the same context as special trains that an organization would book for a holiday, you know, that's the banality of evil, right? The desk murderer, the guy that sits at a desk and doesn't really, you know, have any particularly strong beliefs one way or the other. Unfortunately, Eichmann, you know, tried to curate his memory or his appearance as being one of those folks. But we have recordings even and comments from him that indicate otherwise. And I think one of them, and I'm not going to try to directly quote it, but it's something to the effect of, I think he said it when he was in South America, that, you know, he would gladly jump into his grave knowing that he had helped to kill X million Jews, right? So, you know, he is not your I'm just doing this for purely sort of careerist or, you know, bureaucratic reasons. You know, he is a guy that's ideologically motivated. And so Arendt is sort of, I think, viewed as missing the mark by pinning her theory on him as the example. Though I think the theory itself still has relevance. But again, it all depends. You really have to know about the person and what the person is thinking.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the transition or change in methods of extermination, as you said, initially after June 1941, and I suppose we could go back a little bit further into Poland, they sent in the Einsatzgruppen, and they would often kill Jews under the pretext of them being somehow partisans. This was kind of the code.
Yeah,
for
and,
it,
and
right?
it's a code that I think, and this is something I talked about in the first book, which becomes much more powerful and more institutionalized after the invasion of the Soviet Union, when they're actually really are partisans and there really are lots of Jews that need to be killed, and there needs to be an explanation for this. I think what you often see in Poland with the Einsatzgruppen, at least during that 39-40 period before ghettoization begins in earnest, is the murder of Jews as reprisal. And so often you'll have German army units doing this as well. Częstochowa is one of the best examples of this, you know, where maybe there was a shot fired, or maybe that was a German shot that was fired, or who knows. But Jews are rounded up and used as hostages or reprisal victims to try to, you know, retaliate and to cow the local population. Of course, there also are, you know, Jews that are targeted because they are community leaders or that sort of thing. But really, the Jew as partisan and therefore enemy target is something I think that develops much later in 1941, once we get in the invasion of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that then, because that's really what I'm kind of focused on here, is that they and I'm thinking particularly about the Baba Yar massacre. Because one of the things I kind of knew, but I was reminded by reading your book, is that officially it was a response or a reprisal. Because I guess the Soviets had left what must have been an absolutely enormous bomb in central Kiev that really killed a lot of Germans. But then, yeah, go ahead, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that also is not, I think, you know, necessarily common knowledge. And so it's one of the things that was fun to sort of bring out in the book, you know, the different ways in which these events developed versus kind of how they're remembered. So yeah, the Red Army evacuates Kiev, and the NKVD, the secret police, leave behind essentially, to use a modern, you know, anachronistic term, IEDs all over the place. These bombs that are set to go off at random times or different times or can be triggered. And a German army, a high-level German army headquarters happens to, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you want to look at it, choose to set up in one of these buildings, which then blows up and kills, you know, some generals, as well as lots of other folks. And of course, if generals are killed, then that's, you know, a really big deal. And it's actually the German army that turns to the Einsatzgruppen and the SS and suggests that Jews should be killed as a reprisal action. And then it also provides certain elements to help with the logistics of this operation, you know, to include sort of the engineers to help dig and bury and things like this. But then certainly, you know, it is the largest largest open air mass shooting single day sort of event, with I think 33,000 some Jews of Kiev being murdered. And it's the Einsatzgruppen and the police that carry it out for the most part. And they're certainly happy to do that. But it was the timing and the circumstances behind it are sort of directly related to the war and to, you know, this request by the military, which is another thing that I try to highlight in the book that I think is important for all of us that teach this topic, which is that one can't really teach the history of World War II sort of in a vacuum from the history of the Holocaust and vice versa. You know, these things are connected in a myriad of ways from simply who's occupying what terrain when to how the war is going to things like Babi Yar, where you have individuals interacting and causing these kinds of events to take place.
Mm-hmm. So I find that a particularly revealing instance because I encountered Babi Yar by reading a book by, I think his name's Kuznetsov. What is his name? I really feel embarrassed that I don't remember, but it's an account of Babi Yar. It's a famous Soviet novel, actually. And it doesn't mention this fact, of course. I mean, maybe the author didn't know this. That is the kind of prehistory of it and the attack in Kiev. But it's an important thing to remember when thinking about the Holocaust at that moment. But pretty shortly thereafter, at least within a couple of months, it's decided, I don't know who decides it, I'd like you to tell us, that shooting is not the way to go. That is what's now, I think, called the Holocaust by bullets is going to fade away, and they're going to choose another way to commit genocide. Can you talk a little bit about how they decided that and what they did in the way of experiments?
Yeah, I mean, so this is actually, there's actually two really important elements that you're hinting at here. One is sort of how this plays into the future development of the Final Solution. And the other is, you know, what happens to this Holocaust by bullets? And so to sort of touch on the first element, there is a very clear and very obvious, even in the archival records that remain, recognition by Himmler and others that this process of murdering people, you know, one by one, face to face, or you know, back in close proximity, is destroying the killers psychologically. And I don't say that out of sympathy. I just say that out of the realization that the vast majority of Einsatzgruppen killers and most Nazis were not psychologically, clinically abnormal, right? These are, you know, normal human beings from a mental health standpoint, which means because they're not sociopathic, because they have the ability to empathize, even if they don't want to, even if it's subconscious, that they are then put under an intense amount of emotional stress. And we see this even with Himmler, who visits a shooting in Minsk in August of 1941, and by various accounts, either throws up or is certainly says, hurry this up, get this over with quickly, and wants to get out of there as soon as he can. Another interesting example is a guy named Bogoslavsky, who was the higher SS and police leader for Belarus, you know, who was presiding over the mass killing of Jews and is evacuated for a moment because of hemorrhoids. But while he's undergoing treatment for that, his doctor writes in his chart that he's suffering from flashbacks and all of the classic signs of PTSD. And this is a guy that is a true believer, as is Himmler, which again gets to this point of this very messy, very tangible kind of killing not being ideal. And Himmler himself says, you know, we need to take care of people who are essentially psychologically unfit for duty as a result of this, and not sort of make fun of them and recognize that, you know, this is a terrible thing for them, which fits into a larger interesting narrative where the Nazis would frequently try to paint themselves as the victims here because, oh, we have to do this terrible thing for the good of our country, etc. And so while this sort of thinking is going on, there are individuals in different places geographically who are trying to come up with a you know, and I'm using air quotes here, a better way of doing this from both a logistical standpoint as well as a methods standpoint. And the logistical solution was, why are we sending killers to Jewish populations which are spread out when we can bring Jews to a central location? And so then that's where we get sort of the beginning of the idea of an extermination center connected to a rail network, and also helps to determine why that these camps are in Poland, because that is where at least 3 million Jews are. You also have various experiments with methods, and these can get pretty ugly. One of them was the use of explosives, blowing people up, and that had predictably horrendous results, and from the perspective of the Nazis was not particularly efficient either. And then what you have that I think is really interesting is a connection between earlier German policies, Nazi policies, and then the Holocaust, if you will. And this is the fact that the first Germans to be gassed, the first people to be gassed by the Nazis are predominantly not Jews, but they are Germans, handicapped, in the T4 program. And once the T4 program, is at least forced underground and sort of decentralized, it continues on throughout the war, but it's decentralized, you essentially have a group of people who have a particular set of skills and are out of work. These are people that know how to use gas. They know that gas works to kill people in large numbers. They also are familiar with sort of the subterfuge of transporting people to killing centers and how to manage that. And they are predominantly, in many ways, the people that are then sent to staff these extermination centers in Eastern Europe, because they have these abilities. So some of the big names, people like Franz Stangl, the commandant of Sobibor and later Treblinka, what started out his Nazi career as a sort of a guard policeman in the T4 program, in one of these killing hospitals. And so you have a variety of solutions being proposed. There's an experiment in Berlin using gassing, and then later experiments in Auschwitz in 1941 using Zyklon B, the delousing agent. And so all of these things are happening at the same time that the Nazis are seeking to find a better process to do this. And so that's sort of the answer to the methods piece. But one of the things I also think that is important to raise, and I think that the book raises, is that the Holocaust by bullets doesn't end. And this is something that I think is perhaps a misconception that sometimes creeps into the study of the Holocaust, that everything is sort of then replaced by the gas chambers, which is not really the case. The Einsatzgruppen don't disappear. They're not usually assigned to the extermination centers. They become stationary. Essentially, they take up a permanent position in a town or a village, depending on the size of the unit. And they then become involved in executing ghettos, in deportation actions. And after the extermination centers close down, essentially for a want of easily accessible large numbers of victims, when we start to see ghettos being exterminated in 1943 and 1944, it becomes again these Einsatzgruppen guys, as well as police, as well as local militia groups who are doing this. So the Holocaust by bullets never really stops. It just doesn't become the central method. And we have to remember that, somewhere around 1.5 to 2 million Jews, and that's not including other folks, who are murdered, are killed in this process before the more systematic industrialized gas chamber system begins operation.
Mm-hmm. Now, the killing in the gas chambers, and I think the majority of killing, occurs in a reasonably short period of time. What period of time is that?
Essentially, it's from the early, spring of 42 into the spring of 43. It's about a year, 18 months period where these places are functioning. And they're taking in incredibly large numbers of victims. And they are, if you look at these places, many of them are tied to large Jewish areas, right? So, you know, Treblinka is tied to Warsaw, you know, and Belzec and Sobibor, for example, are often tied to Lublin or to Lvov. So these very large cities are providing a lot of the groups of individuals that are being sent to these places. And as that, as those numbers begin to decline, you know, these places are, with the exception of Auschwitz and Majdanek, though that is now becoming more of a contested discussion of whether or not that's precisely an extermination center or not. But in any case, these other places are either shut down in the case of Sobibor, Treblinka, and Belzec, or shut down and then reopened in the case of Kelmno for a short period of time. But at a certain point, you know, by mid-1943, you really only have Auschwitz and Majdanek as places with gas chambers that are capable of at least larger scale killings. And for the most part, it's Auschwitz. So then, you know, any other mass killings that need to take place revert back to the old method of the pits and the Einsatzgruppen forms of shooting.
Now, one of the things I think our listeners would be interested in hearing about is how, in a sense, I've already said this, Auschwitz has become kind of a symbol for the Holocaust, but actually it wasn't very representative at all of the killing centers or the ways in which Jews were generally killed in 41 through 43. Can you talk a little bit about what made Auschwitz different?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the, I think, misleading terms that, that lots of folks use, and I often slip up and use it myself, is this idea of a death camp. You know, to be more precise, we talk about concentration camps, we talk about extermination centers. That's really the big split. And then, of course, within this this larger category of concentration camps, we can talk about slave labor camps, factory camps, you know, transit camps. There's a variety of different formats. The Operation Reinhardt camps, so that's Sobibor, Treblinka, and Belzec, are really, really actually the industrial model, if you want to take that that metaphor. They're very, very, very small places. And when you visit them today, if you wanted to walk around the perimeter, you know, you could probably do it in half an hour or so. Particularly if you visit Belzec, that you know, the it's incredibly small. When Gitta Sereny was writing about Franz Stangl, I don't remember which of her interviewees mentioned this, but they discussed the terrible smallness, and that's a quote, of Treblinka, how small it was for, you know, killing 750,000 people, because that was the only function of the of those places. The only people kept alive were those who were essentially involved, Jews who were involved in being forced to assist in the killing process, or those that were helping to run, or not helping, but being forced to assist in the running of the day-to-day running of the camp. Auschwitz is sort of the best example of a hybrid camp, because really it's three separate geographic locations, Auschwitz 1, 2, and 3, one being much more of a prison, also the headquarters of the local Gestapo and of a kangaroo court that would sentence and execute, you know, Polish resistors and things like this. You have Auschwitz 2, which is initially designed to be a giant POW camp for Soviet prisoners of war, and later becomes a giant forced labor camp, within which is the famous crematoria and gas chambers. And then you have, of course, Auschwitz 3, Monowitz, which is a giant slave labor factory facility. And then Auschwitz and the town itself were designed to sort of be this long-term, you know, facility that the Nazis were quite proud of. And Himmler was going to have an apartment there, et cetera. And there were plans for a large housing, SS housing community. Paul Jaskot has done work on analyzing, you know, what buildings were built, what buildings were planned to be built but were not built, and what buildings were built in sort of an ad hoc form that were not on on architectural plans, and has come to some really interesting conclusions about what this space was meant to be for the Germans. And it was not something to be hidden, you know, whereas the other extermination centers are sort of, you know, level to the ground and trees are planted and, you know, they were simply instrumental places. Auschwitz is more than that. And it becomes, in many ways, the symbol and, you know, not, again, this is not a competition or Olympics of suffering. It's simply, you know, it's extant, you know, it's liberated extant by the, for the most part, by the Soviets. So it's a physical reminder that that exists and people can visit. It certainly is the apex of the development of the extermination system. And it has lots of survivors. Whereas Belzec, for example, or Kelmno, I think has survivors in the single digits. I think that Belzec has maybe 2 to 3 or 4 or 5 confirmed survivors. Now, that doesn't mean there weren't people that escaped, but that people that escaped perhaps and survived the war. Whereas, you know, Auschwitz, because of its size, we are fortunate to have lots of survivors who can tell their story. But that also means that that tends to become the narrative. So I think that's one, potentially one. And then, of course, you have the very famous folks like Primo Levi, you know, who and Tadeusz Borowski, who write these phenomenally important works and were, you know, that are based on their experiences in Auschwitz. So I think those are some of the reasons why Auschwitz is become sort of the, for some, the symbol of the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about the chapter Hitler's Eastern Allies? And this, I found this completely fascinating. The different ways in which they dealt with the German desire to kill the Jews and others, and it was hardly uniform. I just found it very fascinating that the divergence in kind of responses that these various Eastern European places took. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. This is one of the most, for me, one of the most interesting chapters to sort of research and write. Also, I have to, for the audience, you know, for the listeners, explain a couple of things. One is, you know, if you get the book, the Eastern Allies that I'm calling Hitler's Eastern Allies are Bulgaria, Romania, and Hungary. And there was a methodology, and why did I choose those three? Because they were independent states that remained independent, and or at some level independent. You know, they kept their existing government at least until, for example, in the case of Hungary, until the Nazis literally invaded and deposed the local government, and had some ability to sort of negotiate and had diplomatic relations. And this also gets into something that I should probably mention too, which is I define Eastern Europe for the purposes of this book as essentially from the Baltics down to Ukraine, but not including the Balkans and not including Southeastern Europe. And there are some compelling reasons for this. I'm not the first person to define that. And of course, Eastern Europe itself is in many ways a construction by people in Western Europe and has been for centuries. But for example, the influence of the Ottoman Empire and all of these things made Southeastern Europe something that I was mindful of not including, and also mindful of folks that can make very good arguments for why it should have been included. But to get back to the allies piece, you know, so one could then argue that, for example, Croatia was an ally. But in many ways, Croatia was a giant mess. It was a puppet state. It had areas under Italian control, under Croatian nationalist control, under direct German control. And it really had none of the autonomy, if you will, that these other three existing nation states did. And of course, Poland, you know, while it did have certainly had collaborators, certainly had people that assisted the Nazis, and even had some organizations like the Blue Police, as Jan Grabowski has shown, as a state was not a collaborationist state. And then, you know, Ukraine and the Baltic states are essentially subsumed under German control, which leaves us with, if we really want to look at allies, we look at Bulgaria, Romania, and Hungary, because the Japanese are also an ally, but they really don't figure in this at all. And what I think is important, or one of the things that's important about, and you've brought up some of this, is that because they were allowed to have this degree of autonomy, which part of it was based on the fact that, with the exception of Bulgaria, which didn't send a single soldier to support the German army, you know, these areas had things that the Germans needed, whether it was troops or resources. And so it had some level or some room to sort of negotiate, at least up to a point, how they were going to participate in the Nazi genocidal project and the Holocaust. And so you see some things in common in all three countries. You know, they all were part of that interwar trend in Eastern Europe to become sort of right-wing authoritarian states, with the exception of Czechoslovakia. They all had various bones to pick with the results of World War I in terms of territories that they had lost or others had gained, even amongst each other. And so the Nazis had to sort of navigate that piece of who gets what back. And they all had, in a certain sense, their own colonial project in those particular territories. And one of the issues then is what to do with the Jews, and potentially other ethnic groups that live in these areas that, you know, Hungary or Romania or Bulgaria are trying to incorporate now as, you know, parts of the original state. And then in conjunction with that, each of these states to various degrees viewed its own Jews, in other words, like it's the Jews that were citizens of sort of the pre-World War II state, from a different perspective than it did Jews in territories that it had occupied or had conquered from either the Soviet Union or had been restored by the Nazis from, you know, one of the other of the three states. And so certainly there is Jews in those areas are treated differently than Jews in sort of the home region of these countries. And that, I think, is an interesting realization to come to, as well as the ways in which some of these states, Romania is a good example, imitate what the Nazis are doing, almost to the extent of forming Einsatzgruppen, but also are conducting things independently and in the ways that they choose to do it. And in some cases, push back against the Germans when the Germans are trying to say, you know, hey, hurry up with this. Can you deport your people? And they, for whatever reason, and there are lots of different reasons, many, if not most of which are not altruistic, but are reluctant to do that. And so I think that this particular chapter is instructive in showing, you know, the similarities and differences, as well as the room that these countries had to maneuver, and used to maneuver, to determine sort of how they were going to participate or not participate.
I want to drill down just a little bit deeper, because there are a couple of things in these chapters that I just found really very revealing. And you mentioned just briefly that they had territorial ambitions themselves, and particularly Bulgaria. I think it's Bulgaria. I'm sorry if I don't remember. But they kind of took a chunk of, is it Transnistria? Is that what they took? And then they treated the Jews there differently than their own Jews. But, you know, even if you talk to Russians about Bulgaria, there's even a Russian saying, "Kudytsya ni petitsya Bulgariya ni za granitsa," which means that Bulgarians and Russians are exactly the same. And I just was very interested in these kind of what we would see as these sort of fine distinctions that they made.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that is, you know, it's also a measure of anti-Semitism, you know, and you know, there was a recent book that that just came out by a guy named Roz Segal, which is a fantastic book about genocide in the Carpathians and in Carpatho-Rus and all these other places that sort of overlap in Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary and these places. And one of the interesting points that he contends is that anti-Semitism, you know, takes a different form in Eastern Europe and in these particular regions. And so therefore, you know, the monolithic version of the Ostjuden that the Germans have is not the viewpoint that the Bulgarians have, you know.
Right, because the Bulgarian Jews are very assimilated, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, Bulgarian Jews from sort of, you know, the pre-war boundaries of Bulgaria, what we would call sort of the Kingdom of Bulgaria, are ever deported to extermination centers, which is why I bring up, you know, in this chapter, King Boris III, you know, who is in many ways seen as a hero because of that. But that really wasn't, that's not all of the story. You know, he's very anti-Semitic and supports essentially all of these laws that directly mimic the Nuremberg laws and are put in place in most of these, in all of these three countries. You know, but, you know, he was sort of one of these guys who was, you know, saw what was in the air. And as the war starts going poorly, and again, this is where the war and the Holocaust and the Nazi genocidal project cannot be separated, because, you know, had the war been going swimmingly for the Nazis, there's every likelihood, perhaps, that, you know, these Jews who are viewed as Bulgarian Jews or Hungarian Jews or Romanian Jews may very well have been deported, you know, along with everybody else. But in the initial period, when, you know, Transnistria is occupied, and these other areas that are sort of turned over to these to Hungary and Romania and Bulgaria, they view these Jews as different, you know, as not citizens and not having the same shared past, even and as people to be deported and removed in the same way that the Germans are trying to remove Poles as well as Germans or as well as Jews from areas that they're trying to colonize themselves. And so I think that's a partial explanation of, you know, how these different populations, Jewish populations in Eastern Europe, particularly in these three regions, are treated differently, right? So Hungarians, for example, view these view Jews in what is now sort of Western Ukraine as Galician, you know, or as Polish or something, you know, and so they're foreign, even though the Hungarians are claiming these areas as Hungarian lands and as of having been Hungarian lands forever, the Jews there are considered foreign, and so they don't fall under what little protection there is for sort of native Jews, if you will, of these regions.
Yeah, I wanted you to talk a little bit about, because this is one of these extraordinary revealing episodes that really kind of, whenever I hear about it or think about it, it kind of destroys my monolithic view of the Holocaust. And that is this sort of final spasm where some hundreds of thousands of Hungarian Jews are sent to their death in Auschwitz. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because it seemed to me like it was almost over, and then there it was again.
Right. I mean, this is a great another great example of sort of why these sort of more local or transnational histories, I think, are important, because so Hungary, I always find this amusing. Hungary's, you know, leader during this period of time is a guy named Admiral Horthy. So a landlocked state, you know, is run by an admiral. Yeah. Right. I mean, of course, this dates back to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, you know, that kind of thing. Right. But anyway, and Horthy is not a fan of the Jews. He's not, you know, an ally of the Jews. He's also not necessarily a fervent anti-Semite any more than someone of his conservative aristocratic background would have been normally. And you know, Hungary is a relatively strong supporter of the Nazis. They contribute large numbers of troops to the war against the Soviet Union, and they suffer huge losses in doing so, particularly at Stalingrad. And so, again, here we have the war, you know, interjecting itself into the Holocaust. It becomes very clear with the fall of Stalingrad, with the fall of Mussolini, that the war is not going to go the way that of Nazi allies, that it's not going to be a good thing to be an ally of the Nazis. And so Horthy sort of starts to look for ways out of that, some kind of possible negotiated surrender, particularly to the allies, particularly to the Western allies, because he knows that the Soviets are going to be very, very harsh on him. The Nazis are picking up on this, of course, because they have officials in Hungary, and they're continuing to push for the removal of Jews from Hungary proper. And Horthy is trying to delay, partially because he wants to try to negotiate a surrender and knows that continuing to participate in this process is not going to be helpful. The Allies, interestingly, this is one of the areas in which the Allies we can reasonably say, impacted the Holocaust, is, they're broadcasting that to Hungary that, we know what's going on. We know who certain people are that are participating in this, and you better not do this. They are bombing Budapest. And so it's very clear that, that the Holocaust and participation in the Holocaust is an area of importance, or is it at least a bargaining chip, I think is the way to put it. Long story short, Horthy, who is again not a rescuer of Jews, but also is not someone that is necessarily prepared to hand them all over to be exterminated, delays and delays and delays. And then when it becomes clear that he's really trying to get out of the war, the Nazis, who already have people there, as liaisons and whatnot, invade. And they invade and they install a government that is, very far right extremist, perfectly happy to participate in the extermination of Jews. And they send Eichmann as the deportation expert. And this is the period in July of 44 where you have a little over 400,000 Jews sent to Auschwitz. And it's one of the periods of peak apparitions at Auschwitz, day and night sorts of things, because this large number of Jews is murdered in a very short period of time. But it's because the Germans themselves have to sort of come in and do it themselves. And then very shortly thereafter, Hungary falls to the Red Army and Horthy and all of that is over at that point. But, there was enough time because the Nazis had practiced this enough that once they were able to have unfettered access, they were able to make this happen, which is why you have this, again, sort of, as you mentioned, this last burst of killing that takes place.
I don't know, it kind of puts the lie to the notion that it wasn't a top priority for at least certain sections of the Nazi regime, because this is late in the war and they're losing badly and they don't have anything to spare and they're investing resources.
Yeah, I mean, and this I think leads to an interesting question, the one that I haven't seen a lot of compelling evidence. But, some people will make this argument that, the Holocaust is so important to the Nazis because it detracts resources from the front. And that might be one of the reasons, that the Nazis don't do so well militarily, is that they're losing these resources that they're spending on the Jews. And I haven't really seen any compelling evidence that the resources devoted to the Holocaust detracted effectively from the military efforts and cause any negative outcomes in that regard. And I also would, I think the way that I would respond to that sort of question is that it's sort of a non-question. I mean, the extermination of the Jews is part and parcel of the war itself. And so I think for a lot of Nazi functionaries or people that are making decisions, they wouldn't really see a difference. You know, if they're truly ideologically motivated and they view the Jewish people as a fundamental existential threat to Germany, you know, they sort of feel like they're fighting the war just as much as someone at the front. So I think that's part of the explanation for why this goes on so long. And then there's also, I think, probably just, again, the blatant anti-Semitism of, or we may still lose the war, but we can still kill, you know, hundreds of thousands of Jews if we are able to carry this out. So I think those things are obviously then deeply connected.
Yeah, I quite agree with all that. I do. I don't see how. I'm not seeing, as you said, not a lot of compelling evidence that the Holocaust really cost the Germans tremendously on the battlefield, or even in terms of logistics. I could be totally wrong about this, but it doesn't seem to me it was a terribly important thing. We've taken up a huge amount of your time, but I just find this absolutely fascinating. I think we'd be remiss not to talk a little bit about Jewish resistance. Could you give us some
Yeah, I mean, I thought, you know, and obviously this isn't, again, any stroke of brilliance, but I wanted to certainly highlight in this book as well, you know, Jewish resistance, and the fact that, you know, Jews did not go like lambs to the slaughter, which, bringing us full circle, is at least a somewhat of an argument that that Hannah Arendt makes, you know, that gets her in trouble as well, that, you know, that the Jewish community was complicit, the Judenrats were complicit, and that, you know, Jews didn't fight back enough, et cetera. And so I wanted to show, again, in a volume that covers a lot of different topics, this one is obviously very, very important. And, you know, I tried to begin that chapter with trying to define resistance, because, you know, there is and has been a wide spectrum of debate about what constitutes resistance. Even Hilberg, you know, sort of the founding great historian of Holocaust studies, tended much more towards the, it only counts as resistance if you're really are fighting physically against the Nazis. And then, you know, at the other end of the spectrum, you have historians like Yehuda Bauer who make the argument that if the Nazis' aim is to murder all Jews, then simply existing is a form of resistance. And so what I then tried to do, and I think what is particularly enlightening, is that one doesn't have to choose between those things. And so what I tried to do was show a variety of forms of resistance. And, you know, just to start with the armed resistance, obviously we have the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Everyone knows about that. What a lot of people don't know is that this was not as isolated an event as people may have thought. You know, the Holocaust Museum in DC, in part of its research, estimates that there were armed uprisings in approximately 25% of Eastern European ghettos. You know, this is not a thing that is just Warsaw. Like, Jews all over the place did this. Jews, even in the extermination centers at Treblinka, certainly at Auschwitz, certainly at Sobibor, there's compelling evidence that there was at least one armed attempt at revolt at Belzec. So that's 4 out of the 6, and that's just armed resistance. You know, so and those are in the worst of the worst places, where you have the most limited freedom of action, the most limited access to help and to weapons, etc. And then I also took a moment to talk about some of these partisan groups in detail, you know, like the 50th Brigade in Belarus, as well as some of the purely Jewish partisan groups, as well as Jews that fought with the Soviets. And so we have this armed piece, but we also have, I think, it's very important to highlight, you know, sort of what I call the sort of social cultural resistance, where simply by maintaining one's dignity or practicing religious observances, all of which are illegal, teaching is illegal, you know, all of these things, attempts at dehumanizing people, you know, having classical music concerts, are all forms of resistance. And even within the Jewish community, and again, this is, I think, another important element to highlight, just as it is on the perpetrator side, you know, there are very different viewpoints about resistance within the Jewish community at the time. And even, and not just the obvious one of should we have armed resistance or should we not, even, you know, when you have these musical concerts in Warsaw, there are Jews in Warsaw who are saying, this is almost blasphemous. You know, we are living in a cemetery and you're having concerts, you know, and this is disrespectful and just an awful thing. And then the other people are saying, no, this is trying to maintain normal life and giving people a chance to sort of escape at least for an hour or two from their surroundings. And then, of course, you know, I always want to highlight, you know, two things. One is, of course, to get back to the role of the Judenrats, which I go over, I try to discuss at length. Even they are different, vastly different and diverse throughout Eastern Europe, as are the physical configurations and natures of the ghettos themselves. You know, some ghettos don't even have walls or fences or anything. Some are like Warsaw and have, you know, the massive stone or brick walls. They differ in size. You know, the Warsaw ghetto had more Jews in it than in all of France. The Lviv ghetto had more Jews in it than the Netherlands. But some ghettos were, you know, very, very small and had 100 people in them. And all the Judenrats behaved slightly differently, as did their leaders. And so I talk about the leaders in several of the larger ghettos and how they all approached this, you know, as Lawrence Langer puts it, these choiceless choices they're faced with in different ways. And so you have, for example, the worst of the worst, Chaim Rumkowski, in many ways is viewed that way because he certainly was an egomaniac and he was preferential sometimes in who got deported and was very complicit with the Nazis. But, you know, at least one historian has made the argument that, you know, had the war ended a few months earlier, he would have actually saved the most people in Łódź compared to everybody else, you know. And so, you know, and then would we think of him the same way? But to get back to the resistance piece, I always want to highlight the diversity of viewpoints. But also, for me, one of my heroes, I suppose, of the Holocaust in terms of resistance, and this may be a story that your listeners are familiar with or not, but it's a man named Janusz Korczak, who was a Polish Jew in Warsaw. But before the war, he was a child psychologist. He wrote a lot of sort of scholarly works and popular works about children and about how children have rights, you know, and how children have, you know, should be treated as sort of thinking human beings and, you know, parenting issues and things like this. And he ran several orphanages as well before the war. And so, as happened to many folks, Jewish victims of the Holocaust, when he was in the Warsaw Ghetto, he also ran orphanages there. And as it became increasingly clear that the population of Warsaw was going, or the Warsaw Ghetto was going to be liquidated, many of his friends, non-Jewish Polish friends on the outside, came to him and offered him multiple opportunities to escape and to be hidden, because he was a very famous person that many Poles knew and respected and loved and wanted to save him from what they knew was coming. And he refused. And when the time came and all the children were put on the list for deportation to Treblinka, Janusz Korczak, as well as his teachers and nurses who don't get as much sort of publicity, but were there with him and made the same decision, you know, dressed the children up, you know, told them they were going on essentially on a field trip in the country. And there are multiple survivor accounts and diary accounts and things of people in the ghetto who remember him and his little parade of children singing, and he's holding their hands as they're going to the trains. And then, you know, they end up I think sometime in August in Treblinka, where they all are killed. And for me, particularly, you know, as a father, a relatively new father, I think that's one of the most brave and important elements of resistance that I can point to. Even though he didn't save a single person, you know, he didn't kill a single Nazi, but the fact that, you know, he sacrificed himself simply to try to keep the children as oblivious as possible to what was happening and as unafraid as possible until the very last moment, and that he would go with them, to me is a very, very, very powerful, a powerful action that he took. And he is, in fact, as a coda to that, there's only one individual name written in the memorial at Treblinka, and that's him. Everything else is communities. All the stones have communities that were murdered there. There's a special stone simply to him, in recognition of this particular moment. So I think that's really important too.
I've not heard that story before. The act of resistance, which has, and I think about it a lot, has the most resonance for me, if I could just take a second, is Emanuel Ringelblum. Who, for those of you who don't know, you can listen to an interview I did with Sam Kassov about Emanuel Ringelblum. And he was a historian, and he was in, I don't know if it's the Witch Ghetto or the Warsaw Ghetto, I can't remember which. Yeah. And he said, you know, I'm a historian and my job is to document what's going on so that later generations can understand what happened. And he probably certainly knew that he was going to die and everyone around him was going to die, but he continued in that professional capacity, collecting information, kind of vast amounts of it. He put together a team of people who did this under the most dire circumstances and kind of remained dedicated to their life's work and calling. And he eventually died. I think he was killed. Again, I don't remember the details of it, but I just as historians go, that's a
yeah, absolutely. And
pretty good example.
And you know, Sam Kassow's book, I think it's called Who Will Write Our History, is a fantastic book for that, because, you know, it definitely shows that some people, for whatever reason, you know, they did the thing that they could do, and if it's being a doctor, they were a doctor, and if it was being a nurse, it was a nurse, and if it was being an historian, you know, that's what he did. And he even thinks about this, you know, and there's a quote in the book where he writes about this, and he says, you know, my hand shakes as I write these words. Who knows if a future historian reviewing this list will not add my name, Emanuel Ringelblum, you know. And that to me was also, you know, very, very poignant. And he has a similar story to, you know, the coda for his is that he escapes the ghetto and is protected in hiding until he's betrayed. And then he's sent to the Pawiak prison in Warsaw, which is very infamous. And again, fellow prisoners there offered to let him, to help him escape, but they couldn't help his family. And so he decided that he would stay with his family, and eventually is shot. And so, and again, as you point out, it wasn't just him, you know, he got sociologists and economists and cultural people to, you know, create this history that was then buried in milk jugs of which, amazingly, I forget how many were found. They have not all been found yet, but I think three or four were found and have provided us as historians later just an incredible amount of knowledge about, you know, the conditions in the ghetto and from the Jewish perspective, from people who are no longer here, and then also serves that very important purpose of memory. And these people are now remembered. We, you know, we know who these people are. They are not anonymous victims. They are people who now exist in history, and we can hear their words.
And those are only two stories, and I'm sure that there are thousands
oh, absolutely.
And thousands and
yep.
thousands that we just don't know anything about. Yeah, I think that resistance in that sense was much more widespread than we tend to think about. And I think about Ringelblum a lot. I really do. Like when I sit and write, I think, you know, look at the circumstances under which that guy worked and his dedication to his profession and to the future. It's just Waitman, there's something in my eye.
and you know, he also would actually go and try to intervene and he'd try to pull people out of the line and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know? And he's a pretty amazing person.
Yeah, I know. It's an amazing thing. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, Waitman, as I said, we've taken up way too much. We've talked for an hour and a half now. I can't believe it, but it seems like 10 minutes. Let me say thank you very, very much for being on the show today. I'm going to ask also our traditional
I'm working on a new monograph, which is on it's tentatively entitled Between the Wires, the Yanovska Camp and the Holocaust in Lvov. And the focus of this project is the Yanovska forced labor camp, which is really in Lviv, in what is now Ukraine, what was then Galicia or Eastern Poland. And it's really a fascinating place because it is a hybrid camp. It serves as a transit camp for many, if not most, of the Jews of the region of District Galician to Belzec. So they come through here first. Certainly for the 160,000 Jews in the Lvov ghetto, for the most part, went through here at one point. It also serves as a slave labor camp, providing labor for the city and all kinds of other places. And it is also, and I think this is the most important piece, it also is a dedicated extermination center. And I say that not because it has gas chambers, but because there are routine mass shootings taking place in the hills behind this camp from, you know, the end of 1941 all the way through its evacuation in July of 1944. And this happens elsewhere, but here you have not only your sort of daily executions that may take place, but you have thousands and thousands of people being shot. So as I mentioned earlier in the discussion, you know, Belzec shuts down. And after it shuts down, there is no place to kill the large number of Jews that remain in Lvov and in the surrounding regions. And so they come to Yanovska and they are killed there in their thousands. It's also a really fascinating place because there is an incredible amount of documentary sources, survivors, diaries, Soviet sources, Polish sources, perpetrator sources, maps, aerial photographs from 1944 that really allow me to really get back to kind of the same sort of methodology that I brought to my first book, which is this idea of really trying to look at a micro perspective and really sort of figure out, you know, what's going on in this place. But also really to indulge the digital humanities side of my work. So I'm doing things like looking at social network analysis of the guards and the various other camps that they were involved in the region, and then when they came and left and how that works, as well as we mapped in conjunction with the Scholars Lab here at University of Virginia, which is amazing. We mapped 17,000 inhabitants of the Lvov ghetto based on ghetto work card information. So we know where they lived and who they worked for, which is going to be an important piece of this. And the last sort of digital piece is using this aerial photograph and building a GIS, geographic information system off of it. I'm working with my collaborators to build a 3D model, digital 3D model of the camp, using this photograph, photos from the immediately after liberation, as well as, and I think this is the most interesting piece, one of the prisoners, a guy named Zev Porath, was an architect, and he was installed on the third floor of the headquarters building, designing, you know, buildings and, you know, doing very stuff that certainly was below his skill level. But he sat there and he drew architecturally, you know, rigorous drawings of the buildings in the camp. And so one of the projects that I'm hoping to do in conjunction with this is to create this 3D visualization and then add to it testimony about these different spaces. You know, and so can we map spaces of fear, spaces of economy, spaces of sexual violence, for example, and there's a lot of it, and these sorts of things using a variety of sources to really have an integrated digital project. So I'm really excited about that. And I have to mention in regards to this project that there's a wonderful relationship that's developed between me, my research assistants here at the University of Virginia, undergraduate students who are volunteering to help me with this, a lot of the coding and database development, as well as the Center for the Urban History of East Central Europe in Lviv, who have been simply amazing, as they are also interested in bringing the history of this camp to the public, because it's something that is not present in the landscape of Lviv, or really in the memory of the Ukrainians who live there. And so they're really working to create memorials and signage and things like that. And of course, as often happens, this place is still a prison today. It's a Ukrainian prison. And it's so the site is inaccessible from that perspective. But I'm very excited about this project, as you can tell. And I'm looking forward to moving forward with it.
Well, I hope you come back on the show when you're done with it. I'm sure that you will, because I always enjoy talking to you, even though we only get to talk once every, 4 years?
Well, I'm going as quick as I can, but I really enjoy talking with you as well.
And
having a chance to really sort of lay out some of these issues and discuss them.
Yeah, that's great. So let me tell our listeners that today we have been talking with Waitman Bourne about his book, The Holocaust in Eastern Europe at the Epicenter of the Final Solution. It's a terrific book. I hope to go out and buy it. Waitman, thanks you very much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, as always.
Absolutely. And let me say to everyone who listens to this podcast, thank you for your support of the New Books Network. And I will talk to you later.